So tonight, we're here on week number two with Tom V. I'd like to introduce you to him.
I'm an alcoholic. My name is Tom.
And
based on my closing last week, you're probably as surprised as I am to be sitting here. I wasn't supposed to be here. But as God would have it, he's put me back here, and for good reason. I have a family member that became ill suddenly, and it was best that we had decided that it was best for me to stay close. And so here I am, and I can't think of a better place to be than at an AA meeting sharing ideas and concepts about the big book. So last week we started actually from the beginning on the inside cover, and we came up through into Bill's story, and we spent a large amount of our time on the doctor's opinion, which talked about the allergy, described the allergy. It began to introduce spirituality into this book and into my life. And we're now coming into Bill's story. We just started it. We're on page two, I believe, by the note that or the mark I left in my book. And just to recap, the way Bill writes, I did not fully identify with a lot of the words and the way he spoke and the way he described things. So my interpretation and my receptiveness to Bill's story was not at great proportion in the beginning when I first in my first year of recovery. So my sponsor needed to break it down for me, and I suggest this to you. He talked to me about, did I think the way that Bill thought? Did I drink the way that Bill drank? And was I willing to go to the lengths that Bill went to get sober and recover? So we talked about the way the chapter is broken down, the way that I understand it. The first eight pages are Bill describing his problem. And from bottom of page 8 to 16 was Bill talking about his solution and his recovery. So if we can pick back up on page 2, middle of the page, we had in the middle of that paragraph, though my drinking was not yet continuous, it disturbed my wife. We had long talks when I would still her forebodings by telling her that men of genius conceive their best projects when drunk, that the most majestic constructions of philosophic thought were so derived. So at this point, if you read the first couple of pages, you could see that Bill was full of energy. He was optimistic. His life was in front of him. And now he's starting to discuss more and more how alcohol is playing a bigger part in his life. So it goes on to say, by the time I had completed the course, I knew law was not for me. The inviting maelstrom of Wall Street had me in its grip. Business and financial leaders were my heroes. Out of this alloy of drink and speculation, I commenced to forge the weapon that one day would turn in its flight like a boomerang and all but cut me to ribbons. Living modestly, my wife and I saved $1,000. We went into certain securities, then cheap and rather unpopular. I rightly imagined that they would someday have a great rise. I failed to persuade my broker friends to send me out looking over factories and managements, but my wife and I decided to go anyway. So what that tells me right there is Bill now is getting into the stock market, and at that time, although he talks about I commenced to forge the weapon that one day would turn in its flight like a boomerang and cut me to ribbons, Bill's beginning to recognize and understand that alcohol is taking this role in his life, and it is becoming much more important in his life. It is taking up a tremendous amount of time, and he's not making very many decisions without alcohol involved in it. So he also goes on to say, in the way that I understand this, is that he says, I failed to persuade my broker friends to send me out looking over factories, but my wife and I decided to go anyway. So Bill has made a conscious decision, and if you know some of the backstory to Bill's story, here's Lois married to this guy, and he's kind of headstrong, as we can pick up through there, and he's now decided it's a good idea to pack up all of our belongings, jump in a motorcycle, and they're going to tour up and down the East Coast to try to find out what they can about businesses and factories and manufacturing plants so that he can hopefully, because he doesn't even have a promise, the investors and the broker friends have already told him, no, Bill, we don't think this is a good idea. But he's going to do it anyway. So, you know, here's Lois. I don't know if you can identify with that, but I wouldn't appreciate it if my spouse or my significant other said, we're going to give everything up we have and jump in a motorcycle with the hope and a prayer that we're going to find something. So, you know, there they go. We gave up our positions and off we roared on a motorcycle, the sidecar stuffed with tent, blankets, and a change of clothes, and three huge volumes of financial reference service. Our friends thought a lunacy commission should be appointed. Perhaps they were right. I had had some success at speculation, so we had a little money, but once worked on a farm for a month to avoid drawing on our small capital. That was the last honest manual labor on my part for many a day. We covered the whole eastern United States in a year. At the end of it, my reports to Wall Street procured me a position there and the use of a large expense account. The exercise of an option brought in more money, leaving us with a profit of several thousand dollars for that year. So it turned out okay for Bill. That's feeding his ego and his pride. He was no dope. Bill was smart. He was a very smart man. But he had some success. So now it goes on to say in his story, he tells us, for the next few years, fortune threw money and applause my way. And it says, I have it underlined and highlighted, I had arrived. So Bill now is accumulating material things. He's getting those pats on his back that he talked about in the first page, that he had gotten medals from his when he was in the army from his troop, and now his ego is rising. He's got money in his pocket. I had arrived. I don't know if anyone can identify with that in their lives. My judgment and ideas were followed by many to the tune of paper millions. The great boom of late 20s was seething and swelling. Drink was taking on an important and exhilarating part in my life. There was loud talk in the jazz places uptown. Everyone spent in thousands and chattered in millions. Scoffers could scoff and be damned. I made a host of fair weather friends. So if we learned anything in the doctor's opinion from Dr. Silkworth, he talked about the kicking off the craving of phenomenon. We're going out on a run. We're losing this control. I've lost control as to whether I can decide if I can drink, take a drink, not drink. I'm losing, and it's a progressive disease. So Bill is now going to tell us, he says in the next paragraph, my drinking assumed more serious proportions, continuing all day and almost every night. I don't know if anyone can identify with that, but I absolutely can. The remonstrances of my friends terminated in a row when I became a lone wolf. He's beginning to isolate. I absolutely can feel that and identify that, and shutting off from family and friends and life in general. There were many unhappy scenes in our sumptuous apartment. There had been no real infidelity for loyalty to my wife, helped at times by extreme drunkenness, kept me out of those scrapes. Well, that's good to hear. And in 1929, I contracted golf fever. We went at once to the country. So now Bill's moving out of the city out to the country, saying poor Lois is being dragged with him. My wife to applaud while I started out to overtake Walter Hagen. Liquor caught up with me much faster than I came up behind Walter. I began to be jittery in the morning. This means Bill's starting to go through withdrawals now. Golf permitted drinking every day and every night. But yet, it was fun to caroom around the exclusive course which had inspired such awe in me as a lad. I inquired the impeccable coat of tan one sees upon the well-to-do. Local banker watched me whirl fat checks in and out of the till with amused skepticism. So now, here's the reality of life is kicking in, and it's life on life's terms for Bill. How will he handle this? Abruptly in October 1929, hell broke loose on the New York Stock Exchange. After one of those days of inferno, I wobbled from a hotel bar to a brokerage office. It was 8 o'clock, 5 hours after the market closed. The ticker still clattered. I was staring at an inch of tape which bore the inscription XYZ32. It had been 52 that morning. Here's Bill's reality. I was finished, and so were my friends. The papers reported men jumping to death from the towers of high finance. That disgusted me. I would not jump. Bill's solution is I went back to the bar. My friends had dropped several million since 10 o'clock, so what? Tomorrow was another day as I drank, and the old fierce determination to win came back. So I can identify with that. I was asked to identify with the way that Bill thought. I was asked to identify with the way that he drank, and Bill is rationalizing, and Bill and his delusion, because if you remember last week, we talked about in the doctor's opinion, it says the alcoholic's life seems like the only normal one. We talked about that. We talked about the pain that I know versus the pain that I don't know, and the pain that I don't know is change. And I do not want to give up my alcohol and my dry goods, because I don't know what recovery looks like. So Bill is beginning to fall into that dark place. Next morning, I telephoned a friend in Montreal. He had plenty of money left, and I thought better to go to Canada. By the following spring, we were living in our accustomed style. I felt like Napoleon returning from St. Alba. No St. Helena for me, but drinking caught up with me again, and my generous friend had to let me go. This time we stayed broke. So if you can see, what Bill's describing is this progression of the disease. There's consequences. He was so-called saved from this October 1929 hell that broke loose on the stock exchange by giving a chance to go up to Canada, start over. And what happens? The alcohol, the drink takes over, and there are consequences. So we went to go live with my wife's parents. I found a job, then lost it as a result of a brawl with a taxi driver. Mercifully, you know, this is, can you imagine Lois is going through all this with him, and yet she stays with him, and she supports him. And that's a part of this story that is amazing to me. She has played such a great part in recovery in AA, Al-Anon, and what she has contributed, because she lived on that front line. Merciful, no one could guess that I was to have no real employment for 5 years or hardly draw a sober breath. My wife began to work in a department store, coming home exhausted to find me drunk. I became an unwelcome hanger-on at brokerage places. So here, let's step it up. Liquor ceased to be a luxury. It became a necessity. Bathtub gin, 2 bottles a day, and often 3, got to be routine. Sometimes a small deal would net a few $100s. I would pay my bills at the bars and delicatessen. This went on endlessly, and I began to awaken very early in the morning, shaking violently. He's going through withdrawals. A tumbler full of gin followed by a half dozen bottles of beer would be required if I were to eat anything, any breakfast. Nevertheless, I still thought I could control the situation, and there were periods of sobriety which renewed my wife's hope. So Lois is on this roller coaster ride. Bill's has these small bouts of sobriety where his self-will, his pride, his ego, his disease that's talking to him. My disease talks to me. It sounds just like me. And there were times that I followed it. And Bill's doing that. Gradually, things got worse. I don't know how much worse they could be, but they did, he said. So the house was taken over by the mortgage holder. There you go, Tom. My mother-in-law died, and my wife and father-in-law became ill. So now Bill's going to describe how he gets this opportunity to pull himself out again and what happens. Then I got a promising business opportunity. Stocks were at the low point of 1932. So this is some 3 years later from that crash. I had somehow formed a group to buy, and I was to share generously in the profits. Then I went on a prodigious bender, and the chance vanished. Consequences again, there's the alcohol. I woke up. This had to be stopped. I saw I could not take so much as one drink. So Bill's going through this thing about what we read in the doctor's opinion again, going back to that story that this book is laying out for me. It talks about kicking off the craving a phenomenon, going out on a run, followed by guilt and remorse. I don't know if anybody's ever gone through that before. Maybe you can't identify with that. And here's Bill. I was through forever. Before then, I had written lots of sweet promises, but my wife happily observed that this time I meant business, so I did. So shortly afterwards, I came home drunk. There had been no fight. So it talks about, in the book, it talks to me about this mental blank spot that the stories to follow will describe. More about alcoholism, it talks about the salesman where he describes suddenly the thought came, a little whiskey in my milk couldn't hurt me on a full stomach. It talks about in here strolling across the ballroom floor on my way to the restaurant, and the thought of a highball before the meal would be, you know, and these things in my life, what I could identify when I read this story, which kind of got me hooked on, it made it easier for me to accept this, was what I used to think I changed my mind. I used to just think that, you know, I'm going to make a left, I'll make a right this time. Why? I don't know, but I did. So what was happening with me was my disease, as it was progressing, was causing alcohol and this life that was coming over to consume me. I was powerless, and I didn't know it yet. And that's what I'm reading when I see this, and when Bill says, I had written lots of sweet promises. I meant business, and so I did. Shortly after, I came home drunk. I can identify with that. He says, it hadn't even come to mind. I'm a little further down next to the last paragraph. Someone had pushed a drink my way. I had taken it. Was I crazy? No, you're just insane. I began to wonder, for such an appalling lack of perspective seemed near being just that. So Bill, you know, is coming in on his bottom. He's not there yet, but he's coming in on it. And in the next couple of pages, it's really going to drill down on that part. So if we go to the second paragraph on page 6, And it describes a lot of, you know, I lived on page 52. We're not there yet, but you jump ahead, and on page 52 is you know, we talked about the bedevilments. And Bill's describing the remorse, horror, and hopelessness of the next morning are unforgettable. The courage to do battle was not there. My brain raced uncontrollably, and there was a terrible sense of impending calamity. I hardly dared cross the street lest I collapse and be run down by an early morning truck, for it was scarcely daylight. An all-night place supplied me with a dozen glasses of ale. My withering nerves were stilled at last. A morning paper told me the market had gone to hell again. Well, so had I. The market would recover, but I wouldn't. That was a hard thought. Should I kill myself? No. Not now. Then a mental fog settled down. Here we go. Gin would fix that. So two bottles and oblivion. And that was my solution for a long time. I wasn't a gin drinker, but my solution was definitely alcohol and some dry goods. And Bill's describing that. So I could identify with this. I could identify with the way that Bill drank. That no matter what, being a member of the no matter what club, I'm going to drink no matter what, no matter what the consequences, no matter how I feel, I'm going to spin this thing where alcohol is going to be my solution. So, it talks about this. The mind and the body are marvelous mechanisms. For mine endured this agony for 2 more years. Sometimes I stole from my wife's slender purse when the morning terror and madness were on me. Again, I swayed dizzily before an open window or the medicine cabinet where there was poison, cursing myself for a weakling. There were flights from city to country and back as my wife and I sought escape. The geographical change. I don't know if you've ever gone through the geographical change, and all I did was I took my defects of character, my alcohol and my drugs with me, and we did that in a different zip code, and nothing changed. So it goes on to say, let's go on to page 7, and he's talking about I managed to drag my mattress to a lower floor lest I leap. A doctor came with heavy sedative. So now here's Bill's disease progressing into what my, at that time that I bottomed out, it was Xanax. They call it sedative back then. So for me it was alcohol, Xanax, and cocaine. Next day found me drinking both gin and sedative. This combination soon landed me on the rocks. People feared for my sanity, so did I. I could eat little or nothing when drinking, and I was 40 pounds underweight. So are we having fun yet? You know, this is Bill's life. This is what Bill is describing, and I absolutely, absolutely could identify with that powerlessness. So it says, I skipped a couple of sentences. I was placed in a nationally known hospital for the mental and physical rehabilitation of alcoholics. This is where he met Dr. Silkworth. Under the so-called belladonna treatment, my brain cleared. Hydrotherapy and mild exercise helped much. Best of all, I met a kind doctor who explained that though certainly selfish and foolish, I had been seriously ill, bodily and mentally. So this is where he met Dr. Silkworth. I know I'm sliding back, but I think it's important for us to remember what we're reading, because this book is telling me a story. This is my educational workshop, and it's teaching me that Silkworth talked about the bodily and mentally. It's talking about the allergy. I've got this allergy that I never knew I had. I didn't know that. I didn't know this was a disease. I just thought alcoholics were weak people, had no control. And then it talked about, this book talks to me about the main problem of the alcoholic centers in his mind rather than his body. And this is now being introduced to me to take a look at. So does anybody know what the belladonna treatment is? Has anybody ever heard of that before? Yeah, okay. So let's see if belladonna treatment. It's a treatment no longer in use. Thank you. Developed by Dr. Alexander Lambert, using a sedative created from belladonna plant to treat muscle spasm in the intestinal tract due to nausea and diarrhea. And then they would use belladonna and hydrotherapy. And hydrotherapy was where back then in the day they would wheel you in on a gurney and they would use hot water and cold water back and forth to try to. That was their cure for untreated alcoholism back then. So Joe and Charlie describe it as it didn't get you sober, but you had one clean drunk on your hands. So, so it says it relieved me somewhat to learn that in alcoholics this will is amazingly weakened when it comes to combating liquor, though it often remains strong in other respects. So Bill's going through all of this. He's in the hospital. He's going through all of these treatments. He's going through this time. And the next to last paragraph, it says, "But it was not, for the frightful day came when I drank once more." He drank again after all of this. "The curve of my declining moral and bodily health fell off like a ski jump. After a time, I returned back to the hospital. This was the finish, the curtain, it seemed to me. My weary and disparaging wife was informed that it would all end with heart failure during delirium tremens, or I would develop a wet brain, perhaps within a year. She would soon have to give me over to the undertaker or the asylum. They did not need to tell me, I knew, and almost welcomed the idea. It was a devastating blow to my pride. I had thought well of myself and my abilities and my capability to surmount obstacles. I was cornered at last. Now I was to plunge into the dark, joining the endless procession of sots who had gone on before me. I thought of my poor wife. There had been much happiness after all. What would I not give to make amends? But that was over now. So, and now this next paragraph, this next 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 sentences for me gives a great description of part of step one. It says, no words can tell of the loneliness and despair I found in that bitter morass of self-pity. Quicksand stretched around me in all directions. I had met my match. I had been overwhelmed. Alcohol was my master. And that for me, when I read that, that gave a fairly accurate description of how I felt. The paragraph above that, Bill talked about, you know, his abilities, capacity to surmount obstacles. And Bill had done that. He had accomplished a lot of things. He had gone to war and came back alive. He had made millions, lost it, but he was still able to achieve things in man's world, the non-spiritual world. And I could identify with that. I had things in my life where I had gained success, which I thought was through me, but it was actually me. I learned today we're receiving the gifts that God had given me. So I, at this point in this chapter, I absolutely could really get my arms wrapped around what he was saying. So the part about, you know, I drank once more back in the hospital. So if last week I described that my last 2 years of my drinking career were two detoxes and rehabs and an emergency room. So I'm in and out, and I could absolutely identify, and I'm still relapsing. I'm still drinking. So it says here, Bill says, trembling, I stepped from the hospital a broken man. Fear sobered me a bit. Then came the insidious insanity of that first drink on Armistice Day, 1934. I was off again. So if you've ever heard Bill talk on any of the tapes, he describes this thing about he was going to play golf. Lois thought it was not a good idea, but he figured he would go play golf at his brother-in-law's country club because he could pay the tab, and Bill could play for free. And Bill was on a bus with his golf clubs, and the bus had an accident, and it broke down. So while they were waiting for the other bus to come, Bill and this gentleman he met in the bar went into a bar to have something to eat and wait for the bus, a replacement bus. And Bill went in and told this gentleman his story, and so this man's sitting there listening to Bill give his equivalent of a speaker meeting or tell his story, and his experience strengthened, didn't really have much hope at that point. But this guy is listening to all of what we just read. And the bartender comes up and says, it's Armistice Day. The bar wants to buy a drink. And Bill takes the drink, and he drinks it. And the guy looks at him and says, are you crazy? And Bill describes and says that, yeah, I think I am. And he orders another one. And so, you know, this is what he's referring to on that Armistice Day. If you can get to any of Bill's tapes, silkworth.net, there's on the Tom Murphy website, he's got a bunch of the speakers on there. Bill will tell you this story. And it says, I was off again. So Bill now is beginning to come into his bottom. And everyone became resigned to the certainty that I would have to be shut up somewhere or would stumble along to a miserable end. How dark it is before the dawn. In reality, that was the beginning of my last debacle. I was soon to be catapulted in what I like to call the fourth dimension of existence. I was to know happiness, peace. Have you heard this in Bill at any point up to this point? Do you see where we're going here? Where Bill's going in this story, he's preparing us to get into his solution. So this is the point at the bottom, at the end of this paragraph, where my sponsors and my teachers have told me that this is where Bill's problem ends and he starts to get into his solution and he starts making promises to me. I was to know happiness, peace, and usefulness in a way of life that is incredibly more wonderful as time passes. So he goes on to describe, near the end of that bleak November, I sat drinking in my kitchen with a certain satisfaction. I reflected there was enough gin concealed about the house to carry me through that night and the next day. My wife was at work. I wondered whether I dare hide a full bottle of gin near the head of our board. Thank you, Lord. Gin near the head of our board. I would need it before daylight. Mm-hmm. My musing was interrupted by the telephone. The cheery voice of an old school friend asked if he might come over. Squiggly lines, if you see it, right? Remember, Les, it cost more money back then to write in squiggly lines. It's important. So Bill said he was sober. Bill shocked. And this is why he was shocked. It was years since I could remember his coming to New York in that condition. I was amazed. Rumor had it that he had been committed for alcoholic insanity. I wondered how he had escaped. Of course, he would have dinner, and then I could drink openly with him, unmindful of his welfare. I thought only of recapturing the spirit of other days, a little selfish and self-centered.
Right.
There was that time we had chartered an airplane to complete a jag. His coming was an oasis in the dreary desert of futility. The very thing, an oasis. Drinkers are like that. So here comes Ebby. This is Ebby Thatcher. And they used to run together, and they drank and got in a whole bunch of trouble. And this guy's going to come and see him. So Bill's thinking, okay, here we go. I got a drinking buddy. And we'll mask it with what we'll call dinner, but we're really going to drink. And I don't know if you've been in the rooms and you ever see anyone that's starting to get sober and recover, and you see them one day at a meeting or whatever, and they're different. They look different. You know, they have color. They're happy. They're healthier. They're eating. They're sleeping. They're taking care of themselves. So Bill goes on to describe. The door opened, and he stood there, fresh-skinned and glowing. There was something about his eyes. He was inexplicably different. What had happened? I pushed a drink across the table. He refused it. Disappointed, but curious, I wondered what had got into the fellow. He wasn't himself. Come, what's all this about? I queried. He looked straight at me. Simply but smilingly, he said, I've got religion. It says, Bill, I was aghast. So if you hear Bill's story, so you don't have to take it just from me, he'll describe this. And Bill said in one of his speaker tapes, I felt like I was hit in the face with a wet mop. So that was it. Last summer, an alcoholic crackpot. Now I suspected a little cracked about religion. He had that starry-eyed look. Yes, the old boy was on fire, all right. But bless his heart, let him rant. Besides, my gin would last longer than his preaching. So now Bill's got more gin for himself because Ebby's not drinking, and Bill's okay with that. But he goes on to talk about how Ebby's approach is when he talks to him. But he did no ranting. In a matter-of-fact way, he told how two men had appeared in court. One of those men was Roland Hazard. Google him up. Look at him. Silkworth will describe who it was. Ebby was going to jail up in Vermont, summer place where he had shot up the side of his parents' house. He had painted it. And after he finished painting it, the pigeons had started to accumulate and doing their thing. And Ebby went inside, got the shotgun, and decided to shoot up the side of the house and was arrested. The neighbors had had enough, and he was in court. And one of the men that came was Roland Hazard. And Roland Hazard was one of the men that was introduced to the spiritual part of this program, which we'll get into later on. The two men had appeared in court persuading the judge to suspend his commitment. They had told of a simple religious idea and a practical program of action. That was 2 months ago, and the result was self-evident. It worked. So now Bill can see this. Bill can see that this guy's sober. He knows who he is, knows his history. They ran together. And it says, he had come to pass his experience along to me. He's sharing this, if I cared to have it. I was shocked but interested. Certainly I was interested. I had to be, for I was hopeless. There's the word hopeless again. So that he talked for hours. Childhood memories rose before me. So if you can remember where Bill talked about Winchester Cathedral, and he talked about religion. Bill's grandfather was a very religious man. We'll talk about it here. But his grandfather did not like people. So he felt they were hypocrites. So there was that negative twist on it. But Bill was now being brought back. And that spiritual part for me, the way that this story was broken down for me, was that Bill could see it. He couldn't deny it. He could see that Ebby was sober. He heard how Ebby got sober. He didn't want that. He was hoping for something else. But that's how Ebby was describing his experience, strength, and hope. And Bill goes on and it says, "Childhood memories rose before me. I could almost hear the sound of the preacher's voice as I sat on still Sundays way over there on the hillside. There was that proffered temperance pledge I never signed. My grandfather's good nature's contempt of some church folk and their doings, his insistence that the spheres really had their music, but his denial of the preacher's right to tell him how he must listen, his fearlessness as he spoke of these things just before he died. These recollections welled up from the past. They made me swallow hard." Here's the wartime day in the old Winchester Cathedral came back again. "I had always believed in a power, capital P, greater than myself. I had often pondered these things. I was not an atheist. Few people really are, for that means blind faith in the strange proposition that this universe originated in a cipher and aimlessly rushes nowhere. My intellectual heroes, the chemists and astronomers, even the evolutionists suggested vast laws and forces." Blah, 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 blah. So Bill starts this evening off where he's got his drinking buddy coming. You ever plan something out and then it just doesn't turn out that way? And he's thinking he's going to tie one on with a buddy. They're going to go down, you know, memory lane. And here's this guy that opens his door and says, "I'm sober. And oh, by the way, it's my religious beliefs that have gotten me there." And this isn't the way Bill planned his evening, but this is what's happening. So it goes on, and on the last paragraph, "When ministers of world religions, I parted right there, when they talked of a God, personal to me, who was love, superhuman strength, and direction, I became irritated, and my mind snapped shut against such a therapy." I could understand, I could relate to that. I didn't come into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous to find religion. I didn't come into AA to find God. I came in here because I felt that I was dying and I was trying to save my life. Had nothing, absolutely nothing about spirituality. And so I could absolutely identify with what Bill was feeling at that moment that Ebby sat there and said, "This is his solution. This is what I have to offer." And I could get that. I could relate to that. So we go on to page 11, and in the middle of the page it says, "But my friend sat before me and he made the point blank declaration that God had done for him what he could not do for himself. His human will had failed. Doctors had pronounced him incurable. Society was about to lock him up. Like myself, he had admitted complete defeat, step one. Then he had, in effect, been raised up from the dead, suddenly taken from the scrap heap to a level of life better than the best he had ever known. Had this power originated in him? It's a question. Obviously, it had not. There had been no more power in him than there was in me at that moment." It says, that floored me. It began to look as though religious people were right. Uh-oh, Bill. What's happening here? You know, how do I argue with this? My first sponsor said to me, if you think I'm full of crap, you're not buying my stuff, there's a guy on the other side of the room you happen to get along with. Why don't you go talk to him about his belief? Why is he happy, joyous, and free? Why is he smiling? Why did he go through a terrible situation in his life and he didn't drink? And for me, when I read this, this is what I believe that Bill is going through. In my mind, this is what I'm seeing here, is that Bill can't argue with some of the things that are sitting in front of him. Here it is. This is a guy that's got it. He's doing it. problem is Bill's got this same ego and pride that I have, and this voice in his head that sounds like me, and there's this battle going on inside. And this battle inside of me is just, it's exhausting. And but the good news was that I kept coming, and I stayed close to my sponsor and a fellowship, the men that I had met, a network. It says at the end of the page 11, I saw that my friend was much more than inwardly reorganized. He was on a different footing. His roots grasped new soil. So, skip the next paragraph. That's about Hank Parkhurst. Again, Google him up, Silkworth and Tom Murphy website. It says, my friend suggested what then seemed like a novel idea. He said, squiggly lines, people. Why don't you choose your own conception of God? So when that was suggested to me as I was coming into step two, came to believe in a power greater than myself that could restore me to sanity, and I had to pick this higher power. For me, as much as I had rejected God when I came in, I was angry at God. I was hurt. I didn't have a good understanding of my relationship with God. And my sponsor said, when we read this, why don't you choose your own conception of God? My second sponsor, who is my sponsor now, Carl B., talked to me about this, and he said, where are you getting your ideas, your conception, your beliefs in God? Where are you getting them from? And that, I had to stop for a second, and I had to think about it. And he said, "Well, where?" And I began to realize that I was getting them through my old ideas, my old prejudices. That's really what this was, and it was what I was taught. And I'm a little on step two right now, but what I'm saying is that all of my beliefs in a God came from what my parents taught me. If you remember, I came from a very strict Italian religious family. God, church, big part of a parish, active. Priests at the Sunday table. Both of us looking at that last meatball, trying to figure out who's going to get that. But sometimes he did, sometimes I did. But anyway, the priests and the nuns and going through the through communion and my catechism classes and all of that, and what my conception of what I believe God was, and my conception was the Old Testament. My conception was fire and brimstone. I said last week there were two things that were said on a regular basis in my house. It was, wait till your father gets home and God's going to get you. And those two things were said on a regular basis to me. And I believe both of them, because I believe that a lot of the bad things that happened to me were God. I took credit for all the good things. So he makes this suggestion, and Bill says that statement hit me hard. It melted the icy intellectual mountain in whose shadow I had lived and shivered many years. I stood in the sunlight at last. Squiggly lines. It was only a matter of being willing to believe in a power, capital P, greater than myself. Nothing more was required of me to make my beginning. So when we get into the chapter, we agnostics, we're not really there yet, but when we get to that, that talks about this willingness and an openness. It talks about to consider a power greater than myself that can restore me to sanity. This is what I'm seeing here when I read this, that Bill is going through. So it goes down to the last paragraph. To me, I'm relating this to step two. Thus was I convinced that God is concerned with us humans when we want Him, capital H, enough. At long last, I saw, I felt, I believed, scales of pride and prejudice fell from my eyes. A new world came into view. The real significance of my experience in the cathedral, Winchester Cathedral, remember, burst upon me. For a brief moment, I had needed and wanted God. There had been a humble willingness to have Him, capital H, with me. And He came but soon the sense of His presence had been blotted out by worldly clamors, mostly those within myself, and so had been ever since, how blind I had been. So it says, at the hospital I was separated from alcohol for the last time. Treatment seemed wise, for I showed signs of delirium tremens. So here is step three for me that I see. There I humbly offered myself to God, as I then understood him to do with me as he would. I placed myself unreservedly under his care and direction. I admitted for the first time that of myself I was nothing, that without him I was lost. I ruthlessly faced my sins and became willing to have my newfound friend, capital F, take them away root and branch. I have not had a drink since. So that to me is 6 and 7, those last few sentences. So that's 6 is a willingness, and 7 is the humbly asking God to remove these defects. My schoolmate visited me, and I fully acquainted him with my problems and deficiencies, 5th step. We made a list of people I had hurt or towards whom I felt resentment. That's my 8th step. I expressed my entire willingness to approach these individuals, and admitting my wrong, never was I to be critical of them. I was to right all such matters to the utmost of my ability. That's step 9 in my world. I was to test my thinking by the new God consciousness within. Common sense would thus become uncommon sense. I was to sit quietly when in doubt, asking only for direction and strength to meet my problems as he would have me. That to me is step 10. Never was I to pray for myself except as my requests bore on my usefulness to others. Then only might I expect to receive, but that would be in great measure. That's my 11th step, so to speak, there. My friend promised me when these things were done, I would enter upon a new relationship with my Creator, that I would have the elements of a way of living which answered all my problems. Belief in the power of God, plus enough willingness, honesty, and humility to establish and maintain a new order. So, simple but not easy, a price had to be paid. It meant destruction of self-centeredness. For me, it's the daily killing of self. I have to kill my inner, my defects of character, my ego, my pride. And I have to be on my knees each morning when I say my 3rd step prayer. I must turn in all things to the Father of the light who presides over us all. So these were revolutionary and drastic proposals. I can identify with that, because all of this stuff that's now coming at me in my early recovery, the first time I read Bill's story and could really understand it, and the second and the third time as more and more was surfacing, they were revolutionary and drastic proposals. I now had to take a look. I had to go inward to go outward, if you know what I mean. I had to come inside, and I had to dig in there, and I had to look around in a positive manner, not in a negative manner, to look at myself, you know, and destroy myself, but to take a look at what's really going on in there. What is my thinking? And that's where this is a very powerful chapter. There's a lot of stuff in here. It says, while I lie, back on the bottom of the page 14, while I lie in the hospital, a thought came that there were thousands of hopeless alcoholics who might be glad to have what had been so freely given me. Perhaps I could help some of them. They in turn might work with others. So there's a whole chapter on what he's describing there and working with others. So my friend had emphasized the absolute necessity of demonstrating these principles in all my affairs. Particularly was it imperative to work with others as he had worked with me. Faith without works was dead, he said, and how appallingly true for the alcoholic. For if an alcoholic failed to perfect and enlarge his spiritual life through work and self-sacrifice for others, he could not survive the certain trials and low spots ahead. If he did not work, he would surely drink again, and if he drank, he would surely die. Then faith would be dead indeed. With us, it is just like that. So if you remember back in the doctor's opinion, that on that page, page 31, it says, what is the solution? Right on the top of the page, and it goes on to talk about the hopelessness. It talks about the total abstinence from the alcohol. It talks about the that separation, and it talks about this power greater than us, and it talks about sharing the experience, strength, and hope. If you remember in that chapter, it talked about when Bill asked Dr. Silkworth, could he share, can he tell other people? And that's what this is saying to me. You know, my sponsor will say to me, did you eat today? Yes, I ate. You know, you've all heard this before. I don't know if people have said it to you. Did you eat today? Yeah. Well, how did you feed your spiritual life? That's a living thing. Inside of me, this is a living thing for me. I have to feed that every day. I have to feed it through my program of recovery of prayer. My reestablishing, reaffirming that God is my higher power in my relationship with God through what my readings are and what I do in the morning. And then trying to carry this forward, what we're doing now. Well, we're sitting here together sharing ideas and concepts of recovery and a solution. So I need to continue to feed that spiritual life. So on page 16, it ends up that an alcoholic in his cups is an unloving creature. Our struggles with him are variously strenuous, comic and tragic. One poor chap committed suicide in my home. He could not or would not see our way of life. There is, and here's another promise, there is, however, a vast amount of fun about it all. I didn't see that, but okay, I'll stick with it and I'll keep going, you know. I suppose some would be shocked at our seeming worldliness and levity, but just underneath there is deadly earnestness. Faith has to work 24 hours a day in and through us, or we perish. Most of us feel we need look no further for utopia. We have it with us right here and now. Each day, my friend's simple talk in our kitchen multiplies itself in a widening circle of peace on earth and goodwill to men. Bill W., co-founder of AA, died January 24th, 1971. Died a sober man. So that's Bill's story. There's a lot in there, and I have to tell you, what, you know, that contempt prior to investigation. I hate Brussels sprouts. I'm not eating them. You never had them before. I don't care. I don't like that whole thing. I was ready to just shut this whole chapter down and just not even deal with it. Thank God that I had teachers and a sponsor that firmly and lovingly took me through this and broke it down. You know, a lot slower than we did it here, but he got me through it, and we're able to point out the promises that are in there, and then that I could see that where the steps were. So that's a great chapter. The chapter after this is There's a Solution. So it says there is a solution. It doesn't say there are five solutions. It doesn't say there are three. It says there is a solution. So this chapter for me breaks down into two parts, and it breaks down the fellowship, which is what we're doing right now, and then it breaks down the spiritual awakening, which are the two components for me, which are extremely critical to my staying sober, my staying clean, and recovering. So,
That's it.
That's it?
Yeah.
We're done?
Yeah.
I'm done?
We can open it up.
Okay. So thank you for letting me do this.